You're listening to the London Buddha Centre, talks and seminars from our home in Bethnal Green, exploring Buddhism in a way that is relevant to contemporary life.
So, the first big idea in Buddhism is that mind is the basis of all experience. Yeah? So that's the first big idea. That mind is the basis for all experience. So I'm just going to unpack that a little bit. So what this doesn't mean when we say that is it's quite subtle to understand, actually. So it doesn't mean that the external world is just a mirage somehow. It doesn't mean we're just imagining everything, yeah. Well, in a certain way it doesn't, in another way it does. But anyway, it does. But take it as a sort of working concept just now, that when I say that mind is the basis for all experience, I'm not meaning that the whole world is a mirage. Yeah? It means something more subtle than that. It means that the main force sort of governing how we experience the world is all the thoughts and desires that have been our habits up till now. That's the main force that governs how we experience the world. I say the main force, it's not the only thing that's in operation. There's other laws, if you like, in operation. But it's the main force. It actually is far more, I've come to that more and more as I've been practicing, it's far more than we usually think it is, yeah? We'll be exploring this much more during the week, especially tomorrow night when we're going to be looking at how mind creates world. Yeah, but I'll say a little bit more tonight. And the other way that this has got relevance, this first big idea that mind is basis for all experience, is if we go right back to the very start of Buddhism. So Buddhism, as we know, or even if we don't know, we might imagine, started with the Buddha. And the Buddha was an ordinary human being before he was the Buddha, who became what we call the Buddha, someone who's wakened up to reality. And it basically started with an ordinary human being paying attention, yeah? Paying attention to themselves and their own experience. So Buddhism didn't start with anything outside the human mind. It didn't start with anything outside human experience. That's really, really important. Buddhism isn't a sort of idea added onto the mind. It started with somebody paying attention to their experience. And in a way, it started with someone allowing what they did experience to bother them, in a way. So there isn't time to tell the whole story of the Buddha just now. Some of you will know it and some of you won't know it. But what I can say is that the Buddha, or the person who became the Buddha, suddenly became aware, really properly aware, of the facts of life. Suddenly became aware of the facts of life, the fact that everybody grows old, everybody gets sick, and everybody dies. And there's no exception. There's no exception. And that came like a shock to the young man who became the Buddha. And what's really important is that the Buddha to be allowed that to be a shock. Allowed that to affect and allowed the realization of those facts of life to have an impact. Probably most of us can remember the sort of moment when we became more aware of those things. In some ways, you could say the whole human life is actually allowing those facts of life to touch us more. We can sometimes become aware of them, then we sort of forget, you know. Sometimes we can be very vividly aware of those. If we get ill, if somebody we love gets ill, if we lose somebody either through death or the end of a relationship or so on, we're sort of shocked into awareness of that, aren't we? What the Buddha to be did was he he sort of allowed himself to be shocked. Because sometimes what happens is we're shocked into awareness, and then we kind of, we either forget it or we can't handle it. We run away from it. We kind of cover it up somehow. We do all those things we do to not be aware of it. That's one way we go. Or the other way we go is we are aware of it and we can't handle it and we get depressed or we get despairing, yeah? So the Buddha-to-be did neither of those things. He allowed himself to sort of feel the impact of those things. And also he realised that there could be more than this. We're told that he saw these things quite literally, that he saw an old person, he saw a sick person, he saw a dead person. He'd never seen them before. We're told he was deliberately sheltered from those things by his father, who wanted him to be a king and tried to protect him from those things. But he came across them for the first time. We're also told that he saw for the first time a wandering holy person, as there would have been in India at the time, 2,500 years ago, and still would be today. And also he allowed that to affect him. He allowed the sight of the wandering holy person to affect him. And that fourth sight, he sort of intuitively realised, perhaps this is the way, in the face of old age, sickness and death, perhaps this is the way to find an answer to that great dilemma of human life, yeah? So he allowed all those things to affect him. He allowed all those things to set him off on a quest, and that quest sort of culminated in him reaching, discovering, uncovering this state that we call enlightenment, which is shown here in the Buddha sitting, calm and energised, as Garbhavati was saying, but also radiant. That's why the figure's painted in gold in the figure, that it's not a state of passivity, it's not just a quiet and down state, it's radiant, full of love and compassion. So Buddha, that's another aspect of everything starting with the mind, that Buddhism itself started with the mind, mind, it sounds so abstract, it started with a person paying attention to their own mind, what was going on in their mind, especially paying attention to the experience of suffering. And in the Buddha's case, it was existential suffering. He was happy at this time. Well, you know, he had everything he wanted. We're told he lived in a palace and had, you know, all the, you know, dancing girls you'd ever want, etc. So the suffering wasn't immediate, but the suffering was existential when he realised, well, you know, so much for all this, but it's all going to end in old age, sickness and death. What am I going to do about it? I can't enjoy it anymore. You know, when he realised that he couldn't enjoy those pleasures anymore. So that was what started the Buddha's journey, and it ended in enlightenment, and it ended in a way with the Buddha seeing that mind is the basis for all experience, yeah? So that's the first big idea, that mind is the basis for all experience. As I say, we'll go into that more tomorrow in the subsequent days. The second big idea is that there's two different ways that our minds can operate, yeah? There's two different ways our minds can operate. And this is where the title of the talk and the title of Bhante Sangharaj's original lecture comes from, is the mind can operate either reactively or creatively. These are the two primary ways that the mind operates, the two kind of completely distinct ways that the mind can operate. It can either operate reactively or creatively. And they're completely distinct. It's not operating in both ways at the same time. So I'm now going to say what the reactive mind is. We'll start with that. This comes from the lecture, which we're kind of reviving. That's another thing we're doing on a regular Monday night. We're revisiting these old lectures by Sangharakshita, and sort of reviving them in people's attention, these classic lectures. So the reactive mind operates in a way that's completely conditioned, and it's completely conditioned by external forces, yeah? And basically, the reactive mind is basically the way our mind operates most of the time if we're not enlightened. It's conditioned just through the senses by things that happen. So the example that... the most kind of live example for me at the moment, just a little thing that happened recently, I was talking about it in the study group I'm in with Polly and some others, is last week I was in a really good mood. All day I was in a really, really good mood. And I was really looking forward to my new study group that was starting that evening. I was really excited about it. And I've work at the Buddhist Centre here, I've been working all day teaching and so on, can't remember what I was doing, meeting people, teaching, but I was really enjoying it. And then I had my study group that evening, it was starting at 7:15, and I found myself with half an hour to spare, and I just before the group, and I knew I had to book a hotel for a holiday I'm going on later on in the year, so I thought, oh yeah, I'll just use that half hour to book the hotel. And so I spent half an hour doing that, didn't get the hotel booked. And then just before the study group, I was like, God, like, what's happened to me? Like, I'm really anxious. I'm really, really anxious. I was thinking, how did that happen? Like, all day I've been in a great mood. And now I'm suddenly really anxious. And I thought, God, how? So I sort of asked myself, how did that happen? And I realised, well, of course, it was the half hour spent trying to book this hotel. And I was booking it, as you do, on booking.com. And I said, that's what's happened. My mind's kind of, I'm not as aware as I thought I was. And then the advertising industry takes advantage of that unaware mind and does that thing, doesn't it? Of like, you know that thing, booking.com, there's only two places left. Like, that's what's happened. I've allowed my mind to be susceptible to this external force. So that was quite good to realise that. But that's what I mean by conditioned mind, yeah? Our mind, well, my mind, I mean, here I am, as Grandma Vati said, practice. I'm not a very good advert for practicing meditation for 32 years. You know, my mind is susceptible, it's unguarded, and then is completely conditioned by that external force. And actually, we've got to be really, really wary because those external forces are trying to condition us, you know. That's how it works, you know, the advertising industry. So that's the first characteristic of reactive mind, is conditioned by things outside it. Following on from that, reactive mind is also predictable. I always think it's easier to see this with other people than oneself, but you always have to realise that just as I'm seeing it with other people, they're all seeing it about me. You know how... often you can sort of guess how your different friends will react to different situations, can you? You know, oh yeah, that's my friend who's always cheerful no matter what happens. That's my friend who's tends more on the gloomy side. You know, you sort of know how they'll respond. And there's a lovely little ancient story I'm fond of telling that just illustrates this very well. It's one of the Aesop's fables, actually. And it's the story of, so there's a person sitting on the crossroads, just sitting there, and a traveller comes along, and the traveller asks the person, he says, oh, I'm going to the next village, what's it like? And the original person sitting at the crossroads said, what was your last village like? And he said, oh God, it's like really, really terrible place, like can't trust anyone. Like, everyone just cheats each other, nobody helps each other. You know, I'm so glad to get out of that place. And the person says, I'm really sorry to tell you, like, the next village you're going to find isn't any better. So off you go, so off he goes. And then, so the original person still said, another traveller comes along and says, oh, you know, I'm going to the next village, what's it like? And he said, oh, what's the village you came from like? He said, oh, you know, it's just like such a good place, you can really trust everyone, and everybody's really friendly. You know, I loved it there, really sorry to have to leave it. And he says, I'm delighted to tell you the next village is going to be exactly the same. Yeah. And of course, the moral of the story is, you know, it's the same villages they're talking about. Yeah. So, yeah, how we experience, we will tend to be sort of predictable in a way in our experiences. So that's the second aspect of reactive mind, is that it's predictable. We'll tend to follow the same patterns in mind. And actually, by telling these stories, you can probably already start to see what I mean about our mind creates the world, you know, much more than we think is. We think we're being objective, like, we're very, very rarely being objective. We're very, very often being conditioned by external forces, and also repetitive, so conditioned by how we've been previously. If we tend to see everybody as like really mean and really da da da, that's what we'll be on the lookout for, that, so we'll see that again. So conditioned and repetitive are very, very close together. The basic characteristic of reactive mind is unaware. It's unaware mind. So my little story about booking.com was just a classic example of a mind that wasn't very aware. You know, there I was. I thought I was in a good mood, but it wasn't a very robust state of mind. It was knocked very, very easily, and it was knocked because I forgot to be aware. The good thing was that because I went to the study group and told them this little story, it made me more aware. So then the next time I went to book my hotel on the same website, I just said to myself, okay, so Bedrometi, you know what this is going to be like. You know they'll do that thing of only two places left. Don't worry about it. That's just what they do. That's their job, as it were. Like, they're trying to, don't worry about it. So just with that little bit of extra awareness, I was able not to succumb to, I didn't get anxious. I just said, okay, that's just what they do. Don't worry about it. Just like, carry on, you'll get your hotel anyway, I got my hotel. So that was fine, and I didn't get anxious. So it seems like a small thing, but I think when we're in that unaware mind and we're getting affected like that, then it starts to have knock-on effects. You know, it's a small thing in itself, but, you know, if I then, you know, really anxious, then I'll start da-da-da, things will unfold from there. You know, I'll kind of be cross with somebody and so on, then that'll have effect. So it really matters. So this is reactive mind. I'm imagining people possibly recognise it. We certainly recognise it in other people, don't we? A mind that's conditioned, that's predictable, sort of repetitive, and a mind that's unaware. So that's reactive mind. And the image for reactive mind is the image of a wheel. Yeah. So it's the image of a wheel. And I think that's a very good image for reactive mind because what does a wheel do? It goes round and round. It's sort of continuous. You can't really, the rim of a wheel's got no beginning. You know, it's continuous. It's just going round and round. It's one-dimensional, a wheel. It just kind of keeps going round and round, the same thing again and again. And the other thing about a wheel is it cuts ruts. And I think this is important. If our mind is operating in that reactive mode, the more it does that, the more it will do it. Do you see what I mean? Because it'll cut a deeper and deeper groove for itself in acting in those ways. So if I always get anxious every time I try and book a hotel, I always will get anxious in the future. It's harder and harder. It gets harder and harder to change that pattern, yeah? So that's the image for reactive mind, the wheel. And this big picture that we've got up here that we're going to be going into over the next days of the urban retreat and the next weeks of the Dharma class is called the Wheel of Life. And there's loads in it. I mean, you can come a little closer. There's loads and loads in it. But the main thing I want to point to is there is a wheel being held in the grip of that monster. It's a circular wheel. We're going to give you a little handouts at the end with a version of the picture. But what I'm going to point to, the one other bit of this Wheel of Life I'm going to point to tonight is the middle of it. I don't know if you can see, but you can see in the middle that there's three animals biting each other's tails. It's a quite a striking image of, and they're driving the wheel. And what they represent, we'll maybe see if anybody can guess what they represent. So the three animals are a snake, a pig, and a cock. Can anyone sort of guess what they might represent? You're not allowed to say if you already know the answer. They're biting each other's tail and they're driving this. They're driving the wheel of reactive mind. What drives us when we're in reactive mind?
Negative emotions.
Negative emotions, yes. Who said that? Yeah, negative emotions, that is exactly it. And there's three primary negative emotions represented by the three animals. Does anybody know what they are?
Ignorance,
yeah.
Fear.
Very, very interesting. The fear isn't one of the animals, but it could be. Banti and Sangat just said that almost there could be a fourth animal in there that would be fear. But fear's quite closely related to one of the other ones.
Craving.
Yeah, craving. And envy's a sort of form of craving, yeah, a subsidiary of craving. So you've got ignorance, you've got craving. What's the third grade?
Hatred,
yeah. So they're the three forces that drive reactive mind, yeah, which is our mind most of the time. Greed and hatred and ignorance, and it's very, very interesting that all those animals are biting each other's tails. So the pig is ignorance, the cock is greed, and the snake's hatred. They're biting each other's tails to show that they just they're kind of, you can't really separate them. When you hate the experience you're having, that's linked with you want another different experience, and that's sort of driven by just ignorance of the of reality, really. So there, that's what's driving this reactive mind, this wheel, the wheel of, it's quite called the Wheel of Life. It's also called the Wheel of Becoming. As I say, we'll go into this far more in the coming days. But for now, what we need to know is it's a wheel, it's a reactive mind, and it's driven by greed, hatred, and delusion. So, creative mind is in complete contrast to reactive mind, yeah? Creative mind is the other mode of mind, yeah? So, the important thing to say here is that creative mind, it's not that just that we're trying to replace this wheel driven by greed, hatred, and ignorance. We're not trying to replace it by another wheel. You could be sort of forgiven for imagining that, well, okay, we just need to get a new wheel, but this time it's driven by generosity, love, and clarity. It's actually, we're not trying to replace one wheel by another wheel. I think this is really, really important. I was reflecting on this at the weekend. I went to see a play, called The Plague. You might know it. It's by Camus. And I think Camus is an existentialist. I'm afraid I don't know much about existentialism, so I hope I don't. I'm probably going to do an injustice to any of you who are philosophers. But The Play, The Plague, it seemed to me to be about the eruption of evil. So basically this plague erupts, yeah, in the population. Yeah, this plague erupts. And I think the plague is an allegory for evil itself. And I think the whole thing is, it must have been after the Holocaust, yeah? So I think the plague is an allegory for evil erupting, yeah? And There's just five characters in the play, and there's the good doctor who's trying to save everyone who's dying of the plague, and then there's the baddie who's just trying to take advantage of the fact that there's this state of chaos induced by the plague, yeah? And then some other characters, yeah? So... So what was interesting to me in that is you've got this plague, this eruption of evil, and but all you've got is a goodie and a baddie. Yeah. So it seemed to be saying, unless I've done a sort of grave, misreading, it seemed to be saying, okay, evil erupts, and some people take advantage of that and use it for their own ends, like looting and so on. And some people really try their best to help, yeah, and be a good doctor, yeah, and so on. So some people respond well and some people respond very badly. But what I thought was Buddhism offers a higher vision than that, because on that it seemed to me to be that play, and I might, as I say, have totally misread it, seemed to be suggesting you just take this wheel that's driven by greed, hatred and ignorance and create another wheel, obviously better to have another wheel that's driven by generosity, love and clarity. But Buddhism says even that's not enough. That's good. Better to be on a cycle that's driven by those positive things rather than those negative things. But Buddhism offers something that's a higher vision again, and I'm going to just try and tell you what that is in the rest of the talk. So another way of putting this is Buddhism says, okay, you've got this reactive mind, but it's not enough to just stop reacting. It's good to stop reacting, but actually there's more. If it was just about stopping reacting, well, to tell you the truth, I don't think I'd be that interested in myself. I want more than that. I want more than just a vision that just is like, just stop reacting, yeah? What Buddhism says, and this is the thing I find terribly exciting, is that when there's another mode, this creative mind, that's more than just stopping reacting. And that when we respond creatively, when we act creatively, the whole structure of consciousness of our mind completely changes, yeah? That's the third big idea, yeah? When we respond creatively, the whole structure of consciousness changes. That's the third big idea. That and creative mind is characterized by being spontaneous, so it's not it's no longer conditioned by external forces. It's spontaneous. By the way, that doesn't mean spontaneous doesn't mean just being different for the sake of it. It doesn't mean just kind of being wild and wacky just for the sake of being wild and wacky. Somebody could be being very spontaneous and look, you know, from the outside, look really normal, as it were. Could look really ordinary, could be sitting really still and quiet, but the mind could be completely spontaneous. That's the truly creative mind. So spontaneous means, well, it means free. It means not conditioned. And it means productive. And it means aware, yeah? So creative mind is definitely aware, because it's the aware mind. Well, in a way, that's the first step. That's why we meditate as Buddhists, for example. That's why we practice mindfulness as Buddhists. There's lots of reasons to practice mindfulness, to be calmer, to be more steady and stable in ourselves. But actually, the deeper meaning is to make this transition from reactive mind to creative mind. That's really where awareness, we need awareness for that, and that's a much more exciting reason to be aware, certainly for me. That's much more exciting, yeah. So Yeah, so when we respond creatively, the whole structure of our mind completely changes. And the image for that is a spiral. So if we even think about the notion of a spiral as opposed to a wheel, literally another dimension's added, yeah? So, you know, if you think of a wheel, if you imagine it, I don't know, like, say, if you imagine you're wheeling, if you imagine it on this plane, there's your wheel, it's in one dimension. As soon as you introduce the idea of a spiral, you literally get another dimension added in. So I think that's quite a good, you know, when I'm saying the structure of our consciousness changes, you could say we get another dimension to our consciousness. Just as in a spiral, you get another dimension added. And when you're operating from creative mind, this other dimension is augmentative, is generative. So the wheel's just going round and round in one dimension. Nothing's new is added. You know, sometimes you might be happy, sometimes you might be grumpy, da da da. But when you're on this wheel, you're just going happy, grumpy, happy, grumpy. You know, you're just kind of going from one to the other. On the spiral, one positive state leads to another positive state. Yeah. So creativity leads to more creativity. Responsiveness leads to more responsiveness. I quite like it that it's a spiral. It's not just a kind of ladder up to heaven or something. I think the fact that it's a spiral allows for the fact that, you know, we may revisit, we're growing, but we may revisit old habits and patterns, yeah? But they're kind of, they're, all the time we're getting more and more perspective, all the time we're kind of going up, as it were, this spiral, yeah? The Buddha himself gives a lovely kind of image for this augmentative dimension of the spiral. He says, just as when you have a rainfall on a mountain, the big fat drops of rain fall down. So of course they love the rain because that was the beginning of the monsoon in India. He says the fat raindrops will fall down, and then they'll fill the little gullies and grooves, and then that'll flow down more and fill the tarns, and then the tarns will fill the little rivers, and then the little rivers will fill the big rivers, and then the big rivers will fill the sea, yeah? So you've got this sense of augmentation, yeah? So creative mind is a completely new way of being. It's no longer just going round and round repeating the same patterns. It's moving from contractive mode. That's when we're in reactive mind, it's contraction, getting tighter and tighter, digging grooves for itself, to expansive, yeah, to something that can keep growing, keep generating more and more. And as Vidyadaka said in the advert break, in the tea break, creative mind never needs stop. That creativity is unending. And it gets stronger. The creativity is kind of, but just like those, those little tarns becoming gushing rivers, it gets stronger. It gathers momentum, yeah. And once it gets strong enough, the creative mind sees possibility everywhere. It's more and more. It's harder and harder for it to go back to being reactive, yeah. At the beginning, you know, we'll go from one to the other. Like, we'll have our moments where we're more creative, but then we'll kind of slip back to being reactive. It's almost like we'll slide down the spiral back onto the wheel again. But once it gets strong enough, we'll start to see possibility everywhere. And what we can do, until it is strong enough, we can just start practicing for that now. And one thing I've been thinking about more and more in my life and my Dharma life is just trying to actively and consciously use difficulties as opportunities. That's what I'm particularly trying to train my mind to do, because I notice how much I just allow difficulties to overwhelm me. I'm embarrassed to say that after all, you know, again, these years of practice. Very quickly I can allow difficulties to just get the better of me. And it's almost like what I've been noticing more and more, how many excuses I've got for being in a bad mood. I've got like loads of kind of, I've got my kind of, you know, here I am, like teaching the Dharma. It's kind of easy to kind of sit up here and I can think, okay, this is the bit where I'm positive, but what about, you know, what about first thing in the morning? And I notice how much I think, oh yeah, nobody can expect me to be positive then. That's a bit unreasonable. Or, you know, I've got certain circumstances where I just let myself off the hook, basically. And I've started to see more and more, it's just an excuse for being in a bad mood. What about if I use those difficulties as an opportunity? It's quite a hard practice. It's so tempting to be in a bad mood. It's so tempting to blame. I had an example this very afternoon. Whenever I work full time here at the Buddha Centre, but whenever we have the yearly urban retreat, I usually give myself a little rest in the afternoon because we're here from first thing in the morning till late at night. So I thought, oh yeah, okay, my rest this afternoon. So I went home to my nearby community. And as I got near the front door, I thought, what is that noise? What's that? It sounded like somebody hoovering, but about 10 times as loud as a hoover. Just coming from right behind our front door. And I walked in and my room, there's six of us live in my side of the house, there's 12 of us all together, and my room's on the ground floor. And outside my room was this humongous contraption. And then I remembered, oh yes, like so-and-so, other community member, whose name I won't mention since we've been there. I remember how she said, I'm getting my carpets cleaned today. And so she lives on the top floor. But this huge machine-sucking carpet thing was just exactly outside of my room, making the noise of 10 hoovers all at once, just as I was about to have my rest. And I tell you, the temptation to like just be in a bad mood was like really, really strong. I thought, oh, that's it. Like, how can I possibly like be in a... And also the temptation to blame, oh, why didn't she tell me, you know, why didn't she ask, not why didn't she tell me, why didn't she ask me, was that permissible, you know, why didn't she realise I'd be coming home from my rest, not that she knew about me coming home from my rest. But then I thought, so better Mandy, this is an excuse for abandonment. What if you just thought this could be an opportunity to practice being a bit more creative, which actually didn't take much. I just thought, okay, you don't have to go in a bad mood. There's a choice. I suppose that this is where this comes in. There's a choice. You don't have to go in a bad mood. Don't add a bad mood on top. Then you've got, if you go in a bad mood, you've got, you know, hoover noise 10 times an hour and bad mood. You could just have the noise. Just have the noise. You know what I mean? Instead of the bad mood as well, because that's only going to get me more worked up. So it's quite good in a way knowing you're going to be teaching in the evening because you then you kind of practice a bit. So I did, I'm pleased to report, just thought, I don't know how to go in a bad mood. So I didn't add a bad mood into the equation. And I actually did stop quite soon. And actually, it wasn't that bad once I had the door closed. You know, in the bad mood, you say, oh, I can't go to sleep with this going on, I can't rest with this going on. But actually, if you don't want a bad mood, you can just go, okay, it's just a bit of noise, you know. I can still relax. I did my knitting for a few hours. It was quite nice. I did some knitting. So, and I think it's got two benefits trying to practice like that. Well, it's got three benefits. It's got benefit in the moment. And also, immediately you kind of think, I'll use this as an opportunity for practice. It sort of loosens the whole thing, it makes the thing less bad. And also it's strengthening to the mind. You see how if you just succumb to the bad mood, even in a way if you've got a good excuse to be in a bad mood, you're just on that wheel, you know. You're just on that wheel. What's not actually done you any good. You know, it might be mildly satisfying. Do you see what I mean? Even if you're justified, you're just on the wheel. Whereas if actually you think, okay, I cannot be in a bad mood, you've stepped a little bit onto the spiral, and that means you're more likely to be able to do that in the future. So your mind has become a new kind of mind that's a little bit stronger and a little bit more expansive and has seen a possibility where beforehand they didn't see a possibility. So I find that tremendously exciting. There's a lovely little... in this lecture, my favourite bit, I used to have it written on my wall, this little quote from the lecture. I'll just read it out to you. Bhante Sangharaksha says, "The creative mind loves where there is no reason to love, is happy where there is no reason for happiness, creates where there is no possibility of creativity." And I always think one could expand on that. You know, you could say the creative mind, I don't know, forgives where there is no possibility of forgiveness, is generous when there's no reason to be generous, is brave where there's no reason to be brave. You know, you could expand on it, whatever fits for you. And I really like it, this, it loves where there's no reason to love, yeah? Because in a way, the creative mind, in a certain sense, goes against reason. It certainly goes against reason. I don't mean it's unreasonable, but it goes against reason. It goes against that mentality of, well, you know, I'm not saying I'm sorry till she says she's sorry kind of thing. Do you know that sort of mode of, you know, it's not my turn to take the compost bin out sort of mode, you know. So it requires a leap. It definitely requires a leap. Kind of into the unknown. It requires a leap where you're not waiting for the sort of payback on that level of the wheel. Yeah, you're not waiting for the payback on the level of the wheel. And my favourite example of this is something that happened a long, long time ago, but I've never forgotten it. You may have heard me tell this example before, but it's good enough to repeat, I think. It was years and years ago, and I used to, if you don't know if you know, the cafe next door here is called The Larder. Anyway, we used to run that as a Buddhist cafe. It's not a Buddhist cafe anymore, but we used to run it as a Buddhist cafe, and I used to work there. And it was a Buddhist team, but I'm afraid, although we were a Buddhist team, we were operating from the reactive mind rather more than the creative mind. We were very young, in our defence. And anyway, so but we were all very kind of protective of our own right to, you know, our own day off, our own lunch break, our own. We weren't very generous, in other words. We were all like, if somebody said, you know, can I get an extra day off, we're a bit, no, you can't get an extra day off, you know, kind of thing. So we were all protecting our own back, yeah? And the funny thing is, the more you do that, the more you have to do it. If you create a culture of that, then you've got to keep doing it harder and harder and harder, yeah? And then a new team member came along, and she was called Ratna Dharani. I hope you get to meet her one day. She's at another Buddhist centre, Adhisthana. And she came along and she brought something completely new, which was generosity. Yeah. So she was generous where there was no reason to be generous. They were all of us, protecting our back, reacting mind. She said, she just came in, she said, God, you know, she said, oh, you look a bit tired. She said, tell you what, why don't you go? She said, I'm full of energy. I don't mind working a double shift. Why don't you just go off home? I'm like, okay. And then she was like, God, this staff room's really tatty. She said, tell you what, I'm going to come in at the weekend and really paint it and make it nice for everyone. And she did that. So then all of a sudden, it became catching, you know. We all started to, because she was doing it, we all started doing it. And basically then we created a much more pleasant environment, but also it was better for everyone, because previously each person only had one person looking out for them, i.e. themselves. Yeah? No, everybody had everybody looking out for them. But, you know, I don't know how many were on the team, but quite a lot. And everybody was just looking out for each other. But do you see how it started with a leap? She was generous when there was no reason for generosity. You know, there was no... She just took a leap into that. So that creative mind needs a leap. You know, it needs to love where there's no reason to love. And that has to be an individual choice. You know, you don't... In a sense, I want to say... You can't take my word for it, because you won't get, you might not get anything back on that wheel level, but you will get something back in that you'll have created and you'll start to create a new mind that is more expansive, and also it's a stronger mind. And when I say stronger, I don't mean stronger in the sense of, oh, I don't know. You know, we can think of strength as putting on more and more armour and protecting ourselves, but stronger in the sense of we'll be less... it's a less conditioned mind. It's got more inner resources. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't need everything to be perfect, to be happy, yeah? It can, if you go home and you find this noise like 10 Hoovers, you know, you're more likely then to be able to stay in a positive mental state. You aren't immediately knocked into a bad mood. That's what I mean by a stronger mind. So this is what our work is. You know, if we want to have a more creative mind, you can say this is what our work is to create a whole new set of habits that support creative mind until the creative mode of mind becomes spontaneous. So that's what we're doing. That's what Vidyadhaka was talking about in the tea break. We start by looking for positive conditions, and then eventually it doesn't matter what our conditions are. Yeah. So there's an intermediate step of we look for positive conditions. This is what this urban retreat's trying to do. Is set us up with positive conditions. This is what the whole centre is trying to do, so that creative mind can be, it's not just a theory, it's not just a set of bright ideas, it's something we can actually start to experience. And then it will grow, yeah, it will grow. A creative mind by its nature is augmentative and expansive and cumulative. And it can grow so much that it becomes spontaneous. So I said there was three big ideas. In fact, there's four big ideas. So this is the fourth of the three big ideas, as it were. That if the creative mind can eventually gather such a momentum that we never fall back into reactive mind again. Yeah. Which I think is tremendous. Even saying it, I get a thrill of excitement, yeah? That we can actually... So here we are, we're on this wheel most of the time. We venture onto the spiral. Usually we go on the spiral a bit and then something happens and we sort of slide back down onto the wheel. Then we kind of... Then we're creative again, we go a bit more. And we keep doing that, yeah? But if we keep doing it, you get to a point on that spiral where the only way you can go is to carry on up the spiral. Yeah? You can no longer fall back. You won't stay at the same point because your creative mind will just keep creating. Yeah? There's no sort of standing still, as it were. And then it would just keep unfolding. The Buddha said, and my own teacher, Bhante Sangharaksha, said that is an absolute possibility for every one of us to get to that point where the creativity has gathered such a momentum that there's no more falling back anymore. So that's the fourth of the three big ideas, that there's no more falling back. And then it just keeps on, as Vidyadhaka says, it's unlimited. There's never an end to creativity. It's interesting. We've got the figure of the Buddha, and enlightenment is, in one sense, an end point. It's an end of those negative things that drive the wheel. It's the end of greed, hatred, and ignorance forever. At Buddhahood, there will never again be greed, hatred, or ignorance. They're completely gone beyond. They're completely transcended. So it's an end point in that sense. But also, and again, this is tremendously exciting, it's not an end in terms of creativity. It's only, Bhante Sangharaja said, it's only, we can think of as the furthest point on the horizon that we can see. Yeah, that creativity can never come to an end. How could it? How could creativity come to an end? It would just keep giving way, as it were, to more and more new, more subtle, more creative forms of creativity. A bit like, you know, on a more ordinary level, like how could, say, love ever come to an end? The nature of love, of generosity, of friendliness, of kindness, they can just keep unfolding. We can keep on finding new dimensions of their expression. So creative mind never comes to an end in that way. It comes to an end in the end is there comes a point where there can be no more falling back, but it doesn't come to an end in that it completely keeps going, yeah? And there's more and more creativity. So what I'd suggest that you do, I'm going to say one more thing, but what I'd suggest that you do just in this week, if you're on the urban retreat, if you're a regular on Dharma night, in the coming weeks, is just start to notice when your mind's in reactive mode and when it's in creative mode. And during the week, we'll be keeping talking about this, and we'll be talking more finely about how you make the move from one to the other. What I've done is I've given a very broad sweep of the territory of the whole thing tonight that we're going to unfold all week. But just lastly, we'll be finishing in a moment, is that I wanted to say that there's a collective aspect to this creative mind. The collective aspect is when a whole bunch of people, when a whole group of people are all trying to create creative mind together. That's what Sangha is. That's what spiritual community is. That's what we're trying to do here. That's what we're trying to do when we go on retreat together. That's what we're trying to do when we're on the urban retreat together, is we're individuals, but we're affecting each other. And we're all trying to do that, and we're all trying to help each other doing it, and it's a help even just to be doing it together, actually, then that's what Sangha is. Sangha is a group of people who are all trying to create a mind together. I'm going to leave it there for this evening.
You've been listening to the London Buddha Centre. Make sure to press the subscribe button, and then please take a moment to rate and review this podcast. It really helps other people to find us. Thank you.